Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Walter Isaacson has a new book. We're talking about it this hour. American Sketches is the name of it. Great leaders, creative thinkers, and heroes of a hurricane. He is originally from New Orleans and writes quite movingly about New Orleans in this book. It's a series of essays. Some of them have been included as part of a larger work in the books that he's written, and he's written many books, and some were essays that appeared in Time magazine. Walter is the CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's been chair and CEO of CNN and the managing editor of Time magazine. He's the author of Einstein, His Life and Universe. I think that's the last time we spoke with him about that book, which is a great one. Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, A Biography, co-author of The Wise Men, Six Friends, and the World They Made. He is joining us now to talk about great thinkers, creative thinkers, and his views on a number of topics, including the ideals of the Founding Fathers on democracy, on helping one another, on people who have influenced him, tributes to people who have lived, portraits that he's done of people like Bill Gates and Woody Allen, and there's just a lot in the book. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The pieces, he says, in this collection are about people, how their minds work, what makes them creative, and how they rippled the surface of history. Hello, Walter. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's great to be on your show again.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us again. So I found the first part of the book, well, the whole book is interesting, but how you decided to become, it's sort of a self-deprecating look at yourself here in terms of how you decided to become a biographer and the kind of journalist that you are, instead of a, quote, novelist or a real writer, as
yeah,
your
that
daughter
was my daughter's
said.
line. I was, as I mentioned in the book, I was once asked to write an essay for section of the Washington Post called The Writer's Life, and she said to me, she's like 13 and an aspiring novelist, so very wise. She said, well, Dad, you're not a real writer. You just write nonfiction. You write biographies and journalism. And as I say, I plead guilty to that. I think that narrative journalism and narrative biography, in which you let the tale unfold and we learn lessons from it, is something fun and interesting to do. And I learned it at Time magazine, but I also got to throw myself into it writing biographies.
Oh, I think it's great to write biographies. If I could do something in life other than what I do, it might be to do just that, or to be a Lincoln scholar. But
well, same thing. Lincoln scholars write the most wonderful biographies. There's so many good Lincoln biographies
aren't
out
there
now.
Yeah. The first real writer you ever met, tell me about your relationship with him. And I think that you were seeing him for the last time. You were supposed to be covering, I think, a Republican convention, and instead you were with Walker Percy.
You know, when I was growing up and I was like 12 years old, we used to go across Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans to the Boca Falaya, where we used to fish or water ski or hunt turtles or heaven knows what you do as a 12-year-old. And we always wondered what Ann's dad did, because people in the area called him Dr. Percy, but we knew he didn't practice as a medical doctor. And I kept saying, Ann, what does your dad do? He's at home all day. And she'd say, well, he's a writer. And it didn't really sink in until he wrote that unbelievably wonderful, glorious book called The Moviegoer. And I read it when I was, a teenager. And I realized, oh, a writer is something you can be in life, just like you can be a doctor or a fisherman or an engineer. And so I said, well, that would be a cool thing to be in life. And so I started trying to learn at the feet of Walker Percy. And, he was not the most famous novelist, but he was just this great, genteel Southern novelist. And he taught me many lessons, one of which was when I would look at his books and I'd realize there were messages, there were themes, there were, he was trying to convey moral lessons. I'd talk, they were sometimes even religious, and I would ask him about those, and he would be kind of coy, and he finally said to me, there are two types of people who come out of Louisiana, preachers and storytellers. And he said, for goodness sake, be a storyteller. And so to me, I've always tried to tell the story, let people tell their stories, and we can find the meaning through the story rather than preaching. It's sort of the Bible conveys moral lessons through the tales of people, starting with Adam and Eve. And it's a great lesson to learn in life, which is to let people tell their tales.
And instead of, and the person, it also was a philosophy of the magazine of time, too, and still is to a large extent. There's a person of the year, there's a person of the century.
Yeah, and Henry Luce always used to put a person on the cover. When I was editor, I always put somebody on the cover of Time. And nowadays, it's more often you have a topic or a subject matter that's a cover. But I always felt, as Luce did, that it was really good to introduce our readers to people.
Right.
And so you'd put an interesting person on the cover, even if it was somebody unknown, like, you know, a kid like Mark Andreessen, who had invented something called a web browser. And so you'd put him on the cover with his web browser, and people would learn what that was all about. And, you know, I think that the idea of telling the history of our time through people who make it is one of the things that biographers love to do. And sometimes in the academy, at universities, you know, in the academic life, they correctly point out that focusing too much on people, you lose the general sweep of history and the great forces of history that happen irrespective of leaders and people. But I remember once Henry Kissinger, on one of the shuttle missions he took in the Middle East, he said to the people on his plane, he said, you know, when I was a professor, I used to think that history was made by great forces. But now that I see it up close, I realize that history is made by people.
Mm-hmm. And you've always been interested, and I'm interested in knowing how you decide who has this kind of mind. You're interested in people, but creative people. So the people in this book are all smart people, but they go beyond being smart.
Right. I think that we all know, and you certainly know from your radio show, far too many smart people who haven't really amounted to too much.
Right.
You know? And what we're looking for in life are people who can be creative, people who can take imaginative leaps, people who can think out of the box. Like Einstein, he was not the best educated physicist in 1905. In fact, he couldn't even get his doctorate. He had been turned down for it. He couldn't get a job at a university. So he's working as a third-class examiner in a patent office, but he makes some imaginative leaps. He says, well, if you're trying to synchronize clocks, because that's what they were doing in the patent office, looking at devices that synchronize clocks, he said two distant clocks would look different in terms of whether they were synchronized, whether you're moving or not. So time is different whether you're moving or not. And that's just the basis of the theory of relativity. So I want to look at that creative, out-of-the-box thinking that people sometimes do.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, what was the phrase you used about him, that he wasn't your student that teachers may notice and say, oh, here's a diligent, promising, wonderful student. What was the phrase you used about him, which always gives hope to people who may not be getting good grades?
Distracted school kids,
distracted
or whatever.
He was slow
in learning how to talk as a child, so slow that his parents consulted a doctor. And he was a patron saint of distracted school kids.
That's because, it.
That was the phrase?
That was the phrase.
Yeah, because one of the myths about Einstein is that he failed math all the time, which unfortunately is not true, because that's what makes him the patron saint of distracted school kids as well. If you Google Einstein failed math, you get about 60,000 websites in which people say, you know, as everybody knows, Einstein failed math, so there's hope for me. Actually, he did quite well in math. He just hated rote learning, so he gets kicked out of school by one headmaster. Another kind of amuses us historians by saying this Einstein will never amount to much. But it was that rebelliousness and that slow learning ability that caused Einstein to think out of the box and also to think in pictures. All of his great imaginative scientific leaps come from picturing or visualizing things. And I think that that's one of the problems we have on science. You know, those of us who aren't scientists, we get intimidated by it. We forget that science is a beautiful, visual, aesthetic art, and not just rote learning of mathematical equations. And even Einstein knew that a mathematical equation was something you could visualize. So that's why when he's like looking at Maxwell's equations that define how a light wave goes, he realizes that light always travels at the same speed. So those type of things totally fascinated me.
Mm-hmm. You group these three together toward the end of the book and talk about the lasting impact and the importance that they had to the last century. They are Gandhi, Einstein, and Roosevelt. Why those three?
Well, we were, when we were working at Time magazine in the 1990s, confronted with the fact that we were going to have to pick a person of the century. And we started debating it all throughout the 90s. My friend Jim Kelly, who later became editor after I was editor, he was kind of partial to Franklin Roosevelt. And I think Priscilla Payton, like Gandhi, and Rick Stengel, like Churchill, and we were all debating this. And I decided to look at what the century had become. And partly it was a century of politics and wars, and partly it was a century of individual rights. But it was also a century of science and technology. And so the preeminent person in terms of the politics of the century was Franklin Roosevelt. The preeminent person in terms of individual rights, the breaking away from colonialism, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, somebody who marched against oppression was Gandhi. But to me, you know, 100 years from now, we're going to remember the 20th century as one in which we split the atom, we went to the moon, you know, we invented the microchip, we created the computer and computer networks, and it will be a century remembered for its science and technology, and all of those sciences and technologies, including the laser and the microchip and the splitting of the atom, have Albert Einstein's fingerprints on them.
Wouldn't it be something to be that smart? I mean, it's hard to imagine having that kind of mind.
As I say, though, there are a lot of people who are really smart. Poincaré was just as smart as Einstein. So was Max Planck. So was Lorentz. They're all looking at this question of why the speed of light is constant, no matter how you're moving. But what Einstein had was imagination. And as he said over and over again, imagination is more important than knowledge.
Yeah. Imagination, and also what I think is just as important is kindness and generosity. This guy was a great humanitarian.
You know, I look at the relationship between great leadership and morality in the book as well. Because you look at great leadership and intelligence, and sometimes there's a correlation, sometimes not. But you also have to be kind. You have to have a moral sensibility.
Right.
Henry Kissinger, for example, was very, very smart. He understood intuitively how if you touch one little action of the world over here, it would ripple and affect the world over there. But he was a little bit less appreciative of the role morality and idealism has to play in a foreign policy, especially a foreign policy in a democracy where the people have to understand and support why we're conducting that foreign policy. So I like to look at the elements that make up great leadership in addition to intelligence.
Was Madeleine Albright the same in that category or not?
Madeleine Albright had the great life history of having a family that escaped both the Nazis and the communists. So ingrained in her was a repulsion to any type of repression. And you see that integrated in her life's work, both as a professor and as a Secretary of State and as a diplomat. I followed her around when she was dealing with the war in the former Yugoslavia, and it was a combination that she did so well of America's national interests, you know, what's going to keep our security right, and America's ideals, what values do we stand for. And I've always believed that America's foreign policy is best when it weaves together both its clear national interests with the ideals it stands for in this world.
Mm-hmm. And she did it through wearing pins.
I hope you talked to her at some point about her pins.
We did. It was a great conversation,
delightful.
Isn't she?
She's on the board of our Haspen Institute, and she runs our Middle East policy program.
Oh, she does. Yeah, I just find I really like her. And plus, she's just so genuine, as you are, too. I just like talking to both of you.
It's partly from learning from people like Madeleine Albright, because you hang around here in Washington, and people who are smart and powerful often lose the ability to just be normal
exactly.
folks. And I've learned from Madeleine Albright that being powerful and smart and famous allows you to be more normal and more grounded. It shouldn't propel you to be full of yourself.
Exactly. I'll remember that. Henry Kissinger, tell us this story. I think it was interesting that he was attracted to his critics and felt compelled to convert them, and you were among those people.
Yes. I think, you know, he had a nice, healthy ego and also a little dose of insecurity. So he was always attracted to trying to convert his critics. When I started writing the book, you know, he gave me grudging cooperation, but by the time I was finishing it, he was, you know, calling me up with new thoughts, ideas, stories. Very, very helpful. When the book came out, he was a little bit upset. I think if he reread his own Nobel Peace Prize citation, he'd think it understated his accomplishment. But he was upset that the book, you know, talked about, as I said, the fact that he didn't weave America's ideals and values into the foreign policy in order to make it strong enough. And so for a while, he didn't speak to me. But at one point at Time Magazine, we were inviting all the people who had been on the cover of Time back for a party, an anniversary party, and the phone rang, and it was Henry Kissinger. He said, "Werner Walter, even the 30 years war has to end at some point. I will come to your party." And I realized that, you know, ever since then, I've even though I've been somewhat critical of him, he has always wanted to intellectually engage because he likes intellectually engaging his critics. And by the way, that is a really good thing because so many arrogant people refuse to listen, open up, or engage their critics. And whether it's Henry Kissinger or, for that matter, you know, people nowadays, it's always good when they're open to hearing people that don't agree with them.
How was that party? Did everybody have a good time? Or
that was
tension?
Our 75th anniversary party of Time. It was actually quite interesting because, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about, put people on the cover of Time magazine. When you invite people back who've been on the cover of Time, they all kind of wanted to come back. And so you had Gorbachev sitting there next to Sophia Loren and Steve Jobs sitting next to John Glenn. And so it was like the living covers of Time magazine. You know, Joe DiMaggio was sitting next to Henry Kissinger. And it was interesting. We invited a whole lot of, you know, our readers, our, you know, people, other people as well. And then everybody gave toast to who they thought the important people of the century were. I remember that Bill Gates gave a toast to the Wright brothers because he said the Wright brothers at the beginning of the century tied together people from around the world by the invention of the airplane the same way the Internet is doing at the end of the century. And I know that, you know, Gorbachev gave a toast to Ronald that included Ronald Reagan, which was particularly interesting. And so it was interesting to see who people thought were the greatest influences
yes.
of the century.
Did somebody tape that? That would make such an interesting movie.
Yeah, no, there's a. I don't know if it's on the Internet. I'll check. But we have many, many tapes of it. And there was, it was broadcast on CNN. We didn't want to make it a private party. So I think it was aired as well. And there was some art. I mean, the Alvin Ailey dance troupe did a tribute to Duke Ellington. And,
love them.
Mary Tyler Moore did Lucille Ball. So it was a lot of fun. Tom Hanks did John Glenn.
Ah, what a party. All right, let's pause for a moment. We'll return. Walter Isaacson is our guest. His latest book, American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. Walter is now the CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's been chair and CEO of CNN and managing editor of Time magazine, author of a number of books, including Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, A Biography. We have lines open for him. Our number is 800-486-6855 and the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Walter, 800-486-8655. Eugene from Viola is our first caller. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I just got done with the book of Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things it mentions is people born in different eras, like the 1830s that came of age in the 1870s. Like you take, Mellum, and people like that, and Andrew Carnegie. are those that were born in the late 1930s that came of age in the 50s, like Bill Gates, late 60s. But they all had one thing in common, and they were all willing to work very, very hard. And one side note, I was fortunate enough to be born on Benjamin Franklin's birthday, and my mother let me try anything I wanted to, fortunately.
That's wonderful. You know, it is true that people born in different times, and I love Malcolm Gladwell's book, you know, there seems to be something in the air. Take, for example, the early 20th century, between 1900 and 1925. All of a sudden, we're breaking the bounds of classical thought. The rigidity of the Victorian era suddenly lifts. And in science, you have an Einstein questioning whether time is constant and questioning whether space may be relative. You have somebody like Picasso also playing with time and space and looking at new ways, breaking the bounds of classical art and coming up with abstract art. You have Schoenberg and Stravinsky breaking the classical bonds of the notation scale in music and coming up with new forms of music, and Proust and Joyce doing it, playing with space and time in literature. And so you have these moments of great creativity that go from science to literature. You have that, too, in the Enlightenment period, which is when our country is founded, where people like Benjamin Franklin are playing with science, literature, writing, but also new forms of government. And we had that period of creativity, I think, a little bit in the 60s when it came to breaking the bonds of government a bit in terms of civil rights movements and women's rights movements, but also with the Internet bonding us together. I fear that the past decade has been kind of limp. We haven't had any of those bursts of creativity.
Thank you, Eugene, for the call. Like to join us, our number is 800-486-8655. Bill Gates' name has come up a couple times. That's one of the essays in this book, because you tried to find out who the real Bill Gates was, found him more personable than you thought he might be. A quirky guy, huh? He can do like five things at the same time.
Well, you know, Bill Gates had the mental processing power, almost like a computer chip, a supercharged computer chip, so you could watch him parallel process information and analyze it. The question, and as we go back to the beginning of our conversation, we all know people are intelligent. Did he have emotional intelligence? Could he really connect with people? And often those don't go hand in hand. You can have incredibly smart people who don't have that sort of emotional ability to understand how people work. I think that Steve Jobs, for example, had much more of an emotional side to him, which allows him to invent products like, you know, the Macintosh or the iPod or the iPhone that connect and emotionally connect with a consumer. Bill Gates was much, much greater in terms of his business and analytic processing power. I do think that Bill Gates over the years has shown, too, a very much of a moral and emotional side that you know people didn't realize he had in the 1980s when he was just founding Microsoft.
Didn't he say something to you that he wanted to build this incredible thing that he was building and then give a lot of money away 10 years ago or something?
Yeah, you know, when I was interviewing him, and this piece, one of the pieces you're referring to, was 10, 15 years ago, when he was at the height of his game, and I asked him about philanthropy, and he said, well, I just want to make a lot of money, and then eventually I'll turn to giving it away. And I talked to his dad, Bill Gates Sr., who's and Bill Gates' late mother had been very much a philanthropist, United Way in Seattle, and many of the hospitals and universities there. And Bill Gates Sr. was interested in making sure that his son realized that he was part of something larger than himself, that he had to give back to the community. And even then, they were talking about how are you going to become as great of a philanthropist as you are a computer business entrepreneur. And lo and behold, Bill Gates has become the Andrew Carnegie of this century, of this period, because he has become by far the world's best philanthropist. And I think it was applying both that mental processing power, but also that sense of morality that he does have. And his mentor, I've watched him, whether it's on global health or domestic K through 12 education in America, he drills down. He says, okay, what is the evidence we have that reducing class size improves test scores? What is the evidence we have about malaria nets and the cost efficiency of trying to prevent malaria? So on any one of his philanthropic projects, he does it with that analytic intelligence that helped make Microsoft one of the biggest companies in the world.
But everybody was in sixth grade once, and a sign of a good biographer like you, and you've learned this trade well, is you take him back to sixth grade, and I will think now, because I read what you wrote about him in sixth grade, I'll think about him that way. When his parents, you write, decided he needed counseling, he was at war with his mother, an outgoing woman, Mary, who harbored the belief that he should do what she told him. She'd call him to dinner from his basement bedroom, which she had given up trying to make him clean, and he wouldn't respond. "What are you doing?" she once demanded. "I'm thinking," he shouted back. "You're thinking?" "Yes, Mom, I'm thinking," he said fiercely. "Have you ever tried thinking?"
Well, I think we all know sassy teenagers.
Yes. But
when they did get him, they went to a psychologist. And, of course, Bill Gates became totally fascinated by the psychologist and by psychology. Yes. As a sixth grader, and started reading all the psychology books. But finally, the psychologist said to his mother, don't try to compete with him. You're never going to conquer him. You've got a kid like this, and just let him grow. And indeed, I think people ever since have learned that competing with Bill Gates is not quite as fruitful as learning from him and working with him.
Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Rick from La Crosse is next. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Rick. Go right ahead.
You still there?
Yes, we are. We're getting feedback. Maybe your radio is on. Just talk, Rick. We can hear you.
Yeah. Well, I've studied a lot of these people like Bill Gates, and a lot of them come from kind of upper middle class families. They're kind of, almost privileged. If they were from poor families that had to struggle with money a lot and had a lot of anxiety in the family, I don't think, they would have been as successful personally. There's only one that really stands out in history to me, and that's Charles Goodyear. He invented rubber while in debtor's prison.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin, for example, was the 10th son of a Puritan immigrant to Boston. His father was a candle maker and certainly very, very poor. And Benjamin Franklin famously runs away from Boston to Philadelphia with only 3 coins in his pocket. And he gives away one of the coins to a hungry woman, saying, we're always much more philanthropic when we're poor than when we're very rich, because we want people to think we're rich and also that we're good. And so Benjamin Franklin, even as a very poor runaway with only, a few coins, was both philanthropic and hardworking. He creates himself, makes himself an apprentice at a print shop and then opens up his own printing shop, and he becomes one of the wealthiest people in America, totally self-made. But he does that through creativity, diligence, and hard work. And I think you can see that in many places. Bill Clinton did not come from a privileged background. He hardly knew his father. His stepfather was drunk and abusive. His mother, was a part-time nurse. And Bill Clinton. So I think people who overcome some obstacles, like coming from a family in which the father is an alcoholic or whatever, or who triumph based on their own grit, are very much a part of what America is all about.
How about Abraham Lincoln?
Abraham Lincoln splitting the rails. And so I think that, you could almost make the opposite case that people who are from too comfortable of a background sometimes don't have the grit, determination, or common sense to be strong in this world. And we have to remember, common sense and imagination are a lot more important than education and intelligence.
Thanks so much, Rick, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. Walter Isaacson is our guest, and the book is American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. You write in the book, Walter, that Benjamin Franklin would have been pleased, even tickled, by the election of Barack Obama as president.
Benjamin Franklin felt that the greatest strength of America was the diversity of its people. You have to remember, he ran away from Boston, which was very theocratic and run by the Puritans. He goes to Philadelphia, where there are Moravians and Anglicans and Quakers and Jews and blacks and slaves and freed slaves and all sorts of people from around the world. And he realizes that that mix, if we overcome our tribalism, will make us the strongest nation in the world. During his lifetime, he donated to the building fund of each and every church, black and white, Anglican and Presbyterian and Quaker, that was built in Philadelphia. At one point, he donated to a building they were building called the New Hall that was for visiting preachers. And he said, he wrote the fundraising document, said, even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send somebody here to preach Islam to us and teach us about Muhammad, we should open up and listen and learn. And he was the largest individual contributor to the Mikveh Israel Synagogue, the first synagogue built in Philadelphia. And so that notion of different tribes and ethnic groups working together is what he was fighting for back then and is what we're fighting for in the world today. And in America, one of the, you know, great ethnic divides has been the racial ethnic divide. And the fact that Barack Obama has transcended that, both in his life and in his election, I think would have made Franklin proud. And when I wrote that, I also believed that Barack Obama would be a unifier and a healer in this country, somebody who would bring liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, blacks and whites more together. That has not been the case in the past year. Both health care reform and everything have been divisive. I'm not sure how well. I think part of it is that Obama decided to pursue a more democratic strategy on health care, but I also think there's 100 other factors that makes the poisonous partisanship and the bitterness of our society something that's very hard to overcome and something Ben Franklin would very much want us to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it interesting, the people who are, it's almost as though it was meant to be that these people who are around as our founding fathers, as you write, all had different leadership skills that were so necessary in forming a country. But quite remarkable that there they were. There they were as everything started.
Yes, we were very lucky. And somebody always asks me when I'm talking, what skills and talents do you need to have to be a great leader? And I don't think anyone can have all the skills and talents. If you look at the founders of our nation, you had some people like Madison and Jefferson who were awesomely intelligent and articulate. You had some people like John Adams and his cousin Sam Adams who were very passionate and believed in their principles and would fight for them. You had people who were very noble, like George Washington, and honorable and respected and revered. And then you had very sage people like Benjamin Franklin, who could bring us together, unify us, find the common ground. And as Franklin said, you know, compromisers may not make great heroes, but they do make great democracy. So he added that element to the mix. So it was the mix of leadership skills that made our founders so special. And it's really that lack of a mix of leadership skills that is hurting us in this day and age. Mm.
Let's go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. There was a book I read a couple of years ago called The Electric Universe, and it talked about more or less the personal lives of a lot of people that were involved in great inventions during the growth of electricity. And one of them they talked about was Alexander Graham Bell, and I think he was a speech therapist at the time he was inventing the telephone. And Western Union knew that this was that he was working on something that could destroy Western Union and the telegraph system, and so they had hired somebody to try and steal the invention. And ironically enough, the person they hired was a young man named Thomas Edison.
Right.
And I guess he was an orphan and worked as a telegraph operator for Western Union.
You know, what you had back then was and we're talking about the, say, 1870s to 1900, was an explosion of new inventiveness. And it transforms everything. I love looking at times when technology transforms our society. But you have the telegraph. You have the telephone. You have the phonograph. You have the electric light bulb. You have electricity. And you have these competing power centers, and I guess I'm pun on the word power, but people like Nikola Tesla, who are invented the alternating current version of electricity, actually a much better version than what Edison had invented, but Edison is a much, as you put it, cannier and more clever player in that field, and so he gets the patents more. But it was a mix of inventiveness, ingeniousness, good business sense, entrepreneurial instincts, and competitiveness and drive. David Bodanis wrote the book you're talking about, The Electric Universe, and it's about the shocking true story of electricity, and it's a good metaphor for how we invent things and what types of talents it takes.
Thank you so much for the call, John. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Fascinating conversation. I've got a two-part question for your guest there. You said something that really struck me. You said that imagination and, what was the other word?
Creativity or morality, ideals?
You said imagination and common sense are more important than education and something else.
Right, knowledge.
And knowledge. So, but my question here is, if you could explain that a little bit more. And then the second question is, let's take a Benjamin Franklin, Bill Gates, Abraham Lincoln, whoever. If they had not been born in the particular time slots that they were born in, would they have been as successful in whatever endeavor, you know, that they were into if they were in a different time?
Okay, two good questions. Imagination being more important than knowledge. This is a phrase Einstein uses over and over again. And it's basically because it applied to him. He was not the most knowledgeable of physicists, but he's imagining as a kid, what would it be like if you rode alongside a light beam? What if you got on a light beam and it was a big light wave and you rode just as fast as that light wave? Wouldn't the wave seem stationary relative to you? And he said, but, you know, Maxwell's equations, which are these equations that describe how a light wave works, they don't allow for that. And so he was trying to imagine what could be the cause of a light wave always seeming to be at a constant speed. And his imaginative leap is that, well, time slows down as you speed up. That didn't come from a lot of knowledge. It came from a lot of imagination. Likewise, in this day and age, you take a Steve Jobs. He goes to Reed College for maybe one or two semesters and then drops out and hangs around and takes a few more courses, but he's not really enrolled. And then he wanders down back to Silicon Valley in California and works for a couple of, you know, game companies and Hewlett-Packard. And suddenly he's imagining new types of things, like what if you put a computer on an ordinary person's desktop, and instead of having command lines and coding, you had pictures of a trash can, and you had pictures of a Word document, and people could just operate it. Or he imagined the iPod or the iPhone. So that type of imagination, I think, is what I try to celebrate in this book, American Sketches.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, and people being born in a different time. It would be a wonderful book to write. Like, what would happen if Benjamin Franklin were born today? I think he would thrive today because he would have his own website. He would love to, he was a printer. He would love to have that ability to be a printer around the world by having, you know, the use of the internet. He would love inventing gadgets, which he always did. So he would have invented the iPhone just as fast as Steve Jobs did. There are people, though, who are particularly suited to their time. I think, for example, somebody who was not a great thinker, but Gerald Ford, was very suited to the moment he came along after Nixon to calming down the country.
Mm-hmm. He was. When you say the name Gerald Ford, you think, calm guy.
Well, you know, here's a guy, when we were embroiled still in Vietnam, Nixon and Kissinger had come up with a tentative peace agreement in the early 1973, that didn't quite hold. By 1974 or 5, the war is still going on, but American troops have withdrawn. It's a total mess. And Ford calmly just says, we're not going to get re-involved in Vietnam. It's not our war over there. And it was against a lot of his advisors, but he was right. It was just a calm, collected decision.
Mm-hmm.
And George Bush the Elder was another person like that, who, as the Cold War is coming to a climactic close and the Berlin Wall is coming down, remained quite calm and realistic and didn't try to over-dramatize the situation and help bring a soft landing to the Cold War.
How about Ronald Reagan? He was in the book. Do you put him in that category?
You know, here's why I find Reagan interesting. he's, you know, with all due respect, nobody will say he was the most intellectually engaged or, you know, intellectual of our presidents. However, he had a certain number of fixed beliefs and passions that he believed deeply. What made him good, I think, and unlike some of our leaders today, is even though he had these fixed beliefs, he could reach out and try to find common ground with people who disagreed with him. The two biggest examples, Gorbachev. Reagan has more summits with Mikhail Gorbachev than any other American president and Soviet leader. And they come up with a whole scheme for reducing nuclear weapons that lays the groundwork, I think, for the end of the Cold War. Nobody could have been more anti-communist instinctively than Ronald Reagan, and yet he was able to work hand in glove with Gorbachev. And similarly, even though he's a very conservative Republican, he worked hand in glove with Tip O'Neill, a liberal Democrat, to say, there's got to be a way we can fix Social Security, you know, for the next generation. And we don't do that enough. We don't celebrate the people of deep conviction who then say, but let me find a compromise or common ground with my opponents.
Walter Isaacson, our guest, his new book, American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. He has written about a number of people. He's a biographer and he is a writer. His books include Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, and Kissinger, a biography. He is now CEO of the Aspen Institute and has been chair and CEO of CNN and the managing editor of Time Magazine. Back to your phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Bob from Eau Claire, hello.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine,
Happy
Bob.
New Year.
To you, too.
Yeah. And did you tell Mr. Isaacson that Alan Alda said hi?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey,
Alan Alda was with us last hour, Walter, and he said to be sure to say hi to you.
Well, great. Thank you. And hi to him.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't sure if you'd done it off the air. So, two things actually have come up as I've been listening to you while I've been on the phone. One of them was about Benjamin Franklin. He wasn't a particularly religious person, was he?
He was a deist, like a lot of our founders, including Thomas Jefferson, and for that matter, similar to Albert Einstein, who believed that it was something we couldn't fully understand, but to be reverential at the notion of a creator, something, the creation itself, but not to believe in a personal God who you could pray hard enough for, you know, pray hard to and have Green Bay beat the Redskins or vice versa.
Okay, great. Now, here's my, you said that we had kind of a mini Enlightenment period in the 60s, and I agree with you.
Yeah, I would call it Enlightenment. I would call it a creative period. I mean, Enlightenment, you know, is a very specific term. Yeah.
Progressive. At least it was more progressive. I guess I would advance the theory that the past decade has been extremely regressive. I think we have actually taken a major step backwards, led by the evangelical emergence, if you will.
Well, I think that what America's strength is tolerance. And to the extent that, you know, we're tolerant of various people's religious beliefs, that's great, which makes me very tolerant of evangelicals. To the extent that there's something that goes beyond being an evangelical in which you are not willing to find common ground or, you know, share a society with people who don't share your religious beliefs, you're trying to impose your religious beliefs on others, that goes counter to every instinct that the founders of this nation believed in.
Yes, I agree completely. I enjoy your work, and I will go out and get your book on Franklin. It sounds intriguing.
Well, Benjamin Franklin is certainly an intriguing, in many senses of that word, character.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bye. Bob. When I think of people like him and Einstein, for that matter, and others who have all these talents in so many areas, I'm thinking, what is it? No television that allowed him to do all of this? Or what is it, Walter? How do you have that much time in your life?
Well, I do think there are a lot of time sucks in our life. In other words, things that suck up all of our time, television being one of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes I fear that the joys of the Internet and Twitter and Facebook and all end up sucking up too much of our time. I do, you know, personally, in our household, we just don't have TV, and it frees up a whole lot of time.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a TV in the corner somewhere, so when we have to watch the news or something in particular, but we don't watch TV in the evening. You know, we don't watch shows, and it's amazing how much time there is in a day if you're not if you eliminate some of the things that you know where you could be doing something more interesting.
Right. Thanks, Bob, for your call. Jenny is next from Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Kathleen. First, I want to thank you for this book. I'll definitely have to go out and get it. I find these stories very inspirational. But really what comes out in your conversation is something that has become a major focus in my life, and that is that the way that we are educating people in this culture is clearly wrong for promoting the traits that are the things that really matter in life. So, you know, when you talk about the idea that Einstein brought forward that imagination is really more important than knowledge, that exact trait is something that the way that schools are structured really squelch. They don't allow, you know, you can't, in a school, Bill Gates, if he had been in a regular school or didn't have the parents he had or whatever, would have been stuck in a corner, basically punished because he's probably not doing the thing that he's being told to do because he's busy having these thoughts.
Well, you know, there are two sides to that question, and I agree that, you know, Einstein rebelled and ran away from the schools, got kicked out of his schools in Germany because they taught by rote and didn't foster imagination. But it's before you learn to think out of the box, it's also good to know what's in the box. And I sometimes worry that we don't teach math, science, and English rigorously enough. So, you know, I believe you got to have a mix where
I think there is a mix, but I think if learning is based on passion, you see, a person that's passionate is passionate to find mastery and to make their ideas come true. And because that is squelched, you know, I think genius and creativity is as common as dirt. I think there's kids, if you just look around at many, many kids, on any day, and you listen to them and watch what they do, rather than being so focused on imposing a certain curriculum or a certain, you know, canon of knowledge that has supposedly been important. And it's not that those things aren't important. I guess I'm not really saying that in the right way. But the point is that if things are learned from the point of view of promoting what's bringing out what's inside of a person, which is the root of the word education, educare, which is a Latin term which means to draw out. If that is done, then you won't have to worry about the acquisition of the important knowledge that you're talking about, because you will naturally go towards wanting to achieve that mastery of an area that you are passionate about.
And I think that's true. I happen to be chairman of the board of Teach for America, so I have a passion for good teaching, good education. And I think one of the things our society has got to do is focus more on K-12 education. And it's not an either-or thing of let's try to get kids to be more imaginative. No, let's try to teach them more math and science and English by rote or something. I think you need to have rigorous standards in which our kids know how to read, know how to do math. That said, a good teacher also finds the creativity in every child, and that creativity is different in each child and helps draw that out. So if you had to say what's the key to a great K-12 education system, I'd say great teachers, and that's where we have to focus. I think we're not saying to the best kids coming out of college, you should become a teacher. We're saying you should go to Wall Street and make tons of money. So that's why at Teach for America, we're trying to take the top kids coming out of college and say, why don't you go to an underserved area and teach for a while?
And thanks very much for the call. We have about a minute left, a little bit over that. Let's talk about New Orleans for a moment. It's one of your final chapters. You are from New Orleans. You've been back many, many times since Hurricane Katrina. And you say that whenever you hear, do you know what it means to miss New Orleans, that you've got this overwhelming sense, remembrances of things past. New Orleans is a big part of you, isn't it?
I think home is always a big part of who you are, and we have to remember that in this country. And New Orleans gets to everything I've talked about in this past hour, which is a blend and mix of different ethnic groups that are put together, and out of it comes a creativity and a bit of a magic and a little bit of tension and bad elbow rubbing. All of that is what makes us a great and creative country, is that sort of imagination and magical mix. New Orleans gets destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. I went back down there to try to help as well as I could with the rebuild. And fortunately, New Orleans has come back with that great mix of people. It wasn't just because the federal government paid a lot of money or whatever. People in New Orleans were drawn to making it work. We moved to higher ground. We rebuilt the levees so that the inner part of the city is safe again. And now you have a thriving city with the music, like, you know, the great music that comes out of the city, the great food, but also the Port of New Orleans, which is the key outlet for your state and many others when you grow, grain, or you need to import equipment. And likewise, the oil and natural gas is flowing again. So I'm deeply committed to New Orleans. I know we don't need more federal bailouts, but we just need to celebrate our own creativity and imagination. Yeah. I try to do that at the end of the book.
Mm. Walter, I just love talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kevin, you're a great interviewer, and it's great having this hour and listening to your listeners.
Thanks. Walter Isaacson. The book is American Sketches, Great Leaders, Creative Thinkers, and Heroes of a Hurricane. It has just been published by Simon & Schuster. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production here in our studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 here on the Ideas Network.